Hello and welcome to this new episode of Spill the Wine. My name is still Christoph Ellinghaus. I am recording this again in this beautifully stuffed room above the wine bar. And it is again much too early to drink. So we'll just talk. Today I'm speaking with Erica Anderson, who makes music under the name EMA. She's a born Midwesterner, having grown up in South Dakota. But she now resides in Portland, Oregon, and she was in a noise band called Gowns before she stepped out on her own with a solo debut album called Past Life Martyred Saints in 2011. That record became something of a critic's darling in that year. Everybody in the sort of non-mainstream pop media raved about it, from Rolling Stone to the LA Times. That's the range of critics who praised her as a new and exciting arrival. Sometime later, her second album, The Future's Void, was apparently the favorite thing for Martin L. Gore, who some of you might know as the principal songwriter and musician in Depeche Mode. So he invited her to play a bunch of shows with them. And that is the reason why she was here this week, in Berlin. She opened two shows for them. And so when she talks about A. Martin in our interview, that's who she's talking about, Martin Gore. Here's the disclaimer. Erica and I have known each other for 7 or 8 years. Yes, she releases her music through my label City Slang. But she's also a very smart and interesting and interested woman. And I cannot have enough women on this podcast. So I thought this would be an ideal opportunity to talk to her for Spill the Wine. I hope you agree. I hope you'll listen through it all and you will agree. So let's hear it. EMA and ME up here. No wine.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for joining me on my podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you're in town because you've been opening for Depeche Mode and you're doing it again tonight.
Yeah.
How was the first night?
It seemed good. I'm glad we get to do it like 8 more times.
Wow, 8 more times.
Yeah.
And how about the audience? How indifferent did you have to be to their indifference?
I think actually towards the end, we started kind of, I feel like I made some connection actually.
Okay.
Surprisingly. And from there, I kind of got off the stage and I was like, all right, I want to tweak some stuff. I want to tweak the set list. And I don't know. I feel optimistic actually.
For the next 8.
I mean, I'm sure something terrible will happen and we'll screw up. But at least I was talking to Martin after the show and he's like, oh, well, at least they didn't coin you. And he was saying in the past people used to throw coins and things.
Really?
At their opening acts. So
but I think that band has a very specific thing going on here in Germany.
That's what I've heard.
Maybe as soon as you leave Germany, things will be calm and they'll really appreciate what you do up there. And
I mean, I didn't think it was that bad. I mean, you definitely look at some people who are a little stone-faced.
Right.
And that's another thing Martin says is like, oh yeah, it's not just tonight, it's every night. Those are the same people. So I don't know. Maybe we'll make friends by the end, I guess.
Oh wow. They have So they have these really dedicated followers who follow them around.
Yeah.
Wow. And they are in the front row?
I think they're in there's like a standing room.
Wow.
Place where they're hanging out.
Were you a fan of Depeche Mode before this? Or?
I mean, not as obsessive. Now what I've seen, what a true fan is, how do I even compare?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, fantastic songs, fantastic songwriting, really good sound. You know, you can tell that there's a lot of...
They've been there all your life, you know?
Yeah, they have.
The one and only time I've seen that band was in 1982. What else happened in 1982?
Yeah, I was born. So
I'm kind of looking forward to it tonight.
Oh, no, they put on an amazing show. Yeah. It's incredible. Yeah,
they were good back then.
Yeah, it's an incredible show. Like, you can walk in there kind of being like, you know, yeah, Depeche Mode, I like them. And by the time that you leave, you're completely converted and
plus you know blown every away. Song.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, they're playing a lot of new stuff as okay. well. But I think the new record, the stuff that I've listened to off it, actually gets stuck in my head. Like okay. some of their.
Well, you have eight more times to
yeah.
get it in. All right. So let's enough about Depeche Mode.
Okay.
More about you.
Okay.
Somewhere between the first and the second record, you put out a song and a video called Take One Two.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a real. The video was just the most adorable thing. It showed a bunch of teenagers fooling around in a trailer, I think.
Yeah.
And it, there was, everything was in there. Like, you know, teenage vulnerability and being at odd with things and just, it was just, was that, that was you and you, actually you in the mid 90s, right?
Yeah, me and my
There was this
friends.
Awkwardness and this pureness and this extreme vulnerability, I thought.
Yeah.
And a beautiful song all along.
Oh,
it.
Thank you.
So this is the mid-90s, right? And it's in South Dakota where mm-hmm. you take us back to that time and maybe the what happened outside of that trailer.
Okay. Well, the me and my friends that were in there we were actually, the videos we were making were actually kind of super feminist, left-wing, and political. Like, we were making fun, like, but joking, kind of like. So what we were doing is kind of, like, you know, dressing up. We were kind of influenced by, you know, Riot Girl aesthetics and some politics. But we also didn't really understand it because it didn't really come there. So it was just kind of like our... You know.
You were 15, 14, 15?
Yeah, yeah. So like our like third hand interpretation yeah. of it. You know, so we're dressing up and in this trailer smoking weed, tons of weed, okay. you know. My friend's mom was like a hippie and for some reason she like just didn't really notice that we were just like hotboxing this trailer. I don't know. Huh. And yeah, so we were at the time really, you know, against some of these things that I still feel like our problems in America, which is like the, you know, religious right and evangelicals and like Jerry Falwell and like, you know, a lot of, you know, repressive Republicans. And at that time, like my friend was queer, but kind of closeted. There were a couple of people there that were like kind of, you know, into punk, also queer, but not totally out. Like it wasn't necessarily a totally safe time to be out, like at your high school or whatever, like people would, it wasn't totally safe. But so in there, we kind of could, you know, make our own world, dress up, listen to Bikini Kill or whatever we wanted. And, also, you know,
and
get
film
up
it.
And film it.
Oh, no.
I used to be obsessed with filming. I actually wanted to be like a video maker or a filmmaker, in the midst of being like a punk rocker. And then when I went back to music, I wanted to make experimental documentaries and stuff like that.
So let's go back to the trailer.
Okay.
So
okay.
The world outside that trailer. I don't know the first thing about South Dakota.
Okay. Well, so that trailer park, this is my friend's trailer park.
Did people actually live in the trailer?
Yeah, yeah. It was a trailer park.
Right.
I lived in like my family's from like a, you know, nicer sort of part of town, but we were like best friends. And so we were both like kind of peeking into each other's worlds at this time and spent tons of time in each other's houses. But yeah, it was a real trailer park. So you have like all these kind of mobile homes and they kind of get put in there's kind of like little roads that go through it.
Mm.
But I think, from what I remember, like, I think maybe the one serial killer that had ever lived in Sioux Falls, like, used to live in that trailer park and stuff. And so the trailer parks in the United States have, like, a reputation of...
There's trailer park folklore.
Yeah, for sure. But I thought it was really cozy. Like,
yeah.
I think it's, like, a great solution. And I think, like, I don't understand why there's not... Now more trailer parks in America and more people my age when they're having extreme trouble, like finding places to live and stuff, why that isn't more of a solution. I don't know if it's just the stigma of it or whatever.
It is. I guess there's a stigma going with it. But let's go back to that actual, let's leave it for a moment. So you leave that trailer park. How did you get in and out? You weren't driving, were you?
I started driving at 14.
14.
Yeah,
everyone. Driving age is 16.
Not in South Dakota. Not when I was growing up. No, because of the farms and stuff, you could get your like learner's permit at 14.
So it's pretty rural where you grew up?
I was from the big city of the farmland.
Ah.
So.
How big was that?
I was like 100,000.
Okay. Well,
120,000.
And then spreads out, you know. It's probably...
Yeah, it kind of spreads out. And then like people would. I used to work at this kind of fake Mexican restaurant there called Carlos O'Kelly's, which was like supposed to be half Mexican, half Irish. I don't know. But it's a chain. And, you know, and it was at the mall, and there was a huge mall that was only all one story because everything was just could just be one story there because there was so much land. Yeah. You know, people from all around the small towns would come to the mall to do their school shopping, and then maybe they'd go to Carlos O'Kelly's, and they didn't know how to say any of the Mexican words. You know, they were like the quesadilla.
But the mall was the center of the social... it was like the bus stop. We would always hang out at the bus stop somehow.
People, okay.
You need to hang out somewhere.
Right.
You
know?
You had the trailer.
Right.
Other people had the mall, I guess.
I mean, South Dakota was a real driving culture for kids. Like a lot of people, I remember there was somehow a kid in my middle school, so like eighth grade, that had a car that like picked us up, and then we'd drive around and play music really loud. Mm-hmm. We did that a couple times.
South Dakota is the Midwest, right?
It's like,
when people talk about the Midwest, there's Nebraska right on top of that. Is South Dakota? Isn't that the?
Yeah, I think South Dakota. So there's a river that goes through the middle. There's East River and West River. It's the Missouri River. I think on the east is definitely the Midwest, and then on the west side, there's places like Deadwood, you know, so that's when you think of like the real cowboys. So then I think it becomes a little Wild West.
Okay.
So it's like Midwest on my side.
But there is, you know, people have a certain image of the Midwesterners.
Yeah.
You know, you got your coast people, and then you've got your Midwesterners.
What is the image?
I don't know. I'm asking you. I'm German. I don't know.
You must have some idea.
No, I'm asking you. You've gone to the coasts.
You've
lived on both coasts, right?
I've never lived on the East Coast. I've been mostly West Coast, but I've spent time there.
Yeah.
You know.
So this group of kids in the trailer, were you like the local freaks? Did people know you and you're like, oh, look at those cross dressers and
Yeah, I was like, we were kind of infamous. And also we started a band. There were no girls fronting bands or really playing in bands. So that was another people knew who I was. I had a shaved head. I got arrested the first week of high school for weed. Yeah. So I was like, my friend was driving my parents' car. We were stoned as hell and like 14, you know, and so I had to sit with like, I don't remember if I had handcuffs on or not, but I had to sit like on the main road to the high school during the first week and just everyone's driving by and I'm just sitting there with the police out there and, So people definitely knew who I was there.
Okay. and when did you start making music down there? You just said you had a band.
Mm-hmm. So I started a band with, my friend, the one whose trailer it was actually. Mm-hmm. And she played violin and I was like, hey, do you want to play bass in my band or something? And she was great. It actually was supposed to be started by this guy, Eric Lapegaard, who I think died in a bike accident a few years ago. But he was another one kind of like closet queer, but kind of weirdo. And he wanted to make his interpretation of like a Riot Girl band or something. And I think his aspect of it was less music based, more performance based. But then I kind of got in there and took over, became the boss and wrote songs and stuff.
So this is mid-90s. Were you and this whole Riot Girl thing? How did it get a hold of you where you were?
Then,
you know, how did you even find out about it? What was your initiation to?
I think one
female?
Thing. I know it's so hard to know. I remember going to like a used CD shop one day and buying a Babes in Toyland record and a Bikini Kill record.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know exactly how I heard about them.
So you weren't pulled into the whole thing by the sort of the slick MTV version of it called Hole.
I mean, that was, you know this, I feel like I've told you this, and people are so, it's such a divisive, Courtney Love's such a divisive figure. But like for me, seeing a woman playing guitar on TV when I was like 12 or something. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that completely changed. I don't think I would have played guitar.
But okay, but so you, through that fake stuff, you found the real stuff. So that's good.
So you're the one that's calling it fake. I think interesting.
It wasn't. Well, I don't. I think Courtney's. Yeah, Courtney wasn't a riot girl.
No.
I mean, excuse me, she was a poet and she was a musician and she was a powerful voice. But this whole, I've never bought into the riot girl shtick. I thought there was other girls who did that more meaningful and better. But that's just me. I mean, you know.
Well, I mean, that's what we didn't even know enough to distinguish. You know what I mean? Like we didn't, we were like 13 and we didn't even, we were just like, oh,
and she
women
had
playing
powerful songs. I mean, and they were all over the TV and radio and whatnot.
Yeah. No, that, Live Through This is definitely one of my most, influential records. And I also had like live bootlegs.
But what I'm saying is this is kind of as designer Riot Girl as say, Designer Revolutionary as Rage Against the Machine was, you know. And then you realize, well, this band is actually signed to a multi-national corporation called Sony or Universal or something. And this is kind of, it's come on, it's the commercialization of a feeling and a vibe. But that's, you know.
I mean, I think what you're getting at more to me, not necessarily that.
You can still be angry on Geffen Records, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think what you're talking about is just in some ways how success can change, like, you know, success or certain, like, industry standards or something can kind of warp things more than what they started with. You know, because if Rage Against the Machine had never, I don't know, I don't remember where they're from. Nah. But if they had never, you know, gone any further than, like, playing on, like, the punk circuit.
Right.
You know, who knows?
Now, you can't really accuse them of that. That's true.
Yeah,
no, I mean, I'm just saying there's that, there's this and there's that. I think there's different levels of authenticity when it comes to these kinds of things. And, you know.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think actresses are kind of an interesting.
But that's your job. You pretend you're something else.
Right. But I mean, like, it happens over and over. Like, there'll be like a young it girl and everyone will be like, oh, wow, she's so fresh and she's so exciting. And then like within 2 years, whatever edges that person had are just completely like kind of shaved off, you know, and they just, you look at them on the red carpet and they look exactly like everybody else within. I mean, I just think it's really actually what we're talking about here is resisting capitalism, show business, the patriarchy, all the, and like those are really strong.
That's true.
Things.
You know who would be turning 75 today?
Who?
Janis Joplin.
Oh wow.
Would be.
Wow.
Yeah. That talk about the first female strong powerhouse to break into a white male dominated thing. I mean, God, she was there. She was spearheading a lot, I think.
Yeah.
Anyways, just on the side. We all learn things by imitating. We learn to walk and speak by imitating other people.
Yeah.
Who did you imitate? And when did you feel, okay, I'm coming into my own here? Artistically.
That's a good question. I mean, I think honestly, as soon as I learned how to use Pro Tools.
Oh.
Then I was totally, that was it, I think. And I used to make 4-track recordings and stuff. And I think some of them are pretty interesting. You know, they're okay. They're not like terrible, but there's, you know, not like teenage genius happening or anything.
Hmm.
But when I went to school, I actually studied video because I said I wanted to be like a video maker. And so I learned how to do this non-linear editing. Mm-hmm. And I got really into these forms of like collage and, things with like Final Cut Pro and adding layers. And I got really kind of like obsessive with cutting things up and making things a certain way and using processing and all this stuff. And then when I got out, I got Pro Tools, which is like audio editing software. I had an MBox One, which is what the first Gowns record was made on for the EP as well. And then I got some plugins, mm-hmm. which is like the effects.
Yeah.
And then it was like from there, I was just like, okay, this is what I'm doing. And I don't know. I feel like I kind of instantly just.
This was, where were you at that time?
I was in California.
Okay. When did you get out? When did you get out of South
Dakota? Like 18.
Okay. And what was Amps for Christ?
Oh yeah. Okay. So Amps for Christ was, a band with Henry Barnes, who was in Man is the Bastard. It was kind of like a power violence band. So that's like, this is what they were called. They were called power violence. And it was like kind of like extreme hardcore in a way, but kind of slow and just sludgy. And, you know, so they kind of had a cult following. But he was doing these things like taking things like the, you know, the child ballads, which is like the ballads of the English, you know, the British Isles and stuff, and mixing it with electronics. And also, Tara Tavi, who became like one of my best friends out there, you know, adding her, hammered dulcimer and Eastern music influence. Mm-hmm. And they made something like I had just basically never heard before, which I felt like was its own sonic language, like completely. I mean, now that I have listened to some of the child ballads and some of that stuff, I can see a little bit more where they were taking from and where those influences were. But sonically, it mm-hmm. felt so particular. And that was a big influence on me as well. And I think growing up in South Dakota with there was a good like music scene there. There were tons of shows. There was a booker booking tons of shows.
Oh, wow.
Because all these bands would come through and it's the middle of nowhere. Mm. And these kids had nothing to do. So you would, excuse me, sometimes you'd be able to, book shows and have like 300 kids show up. Whereas like, you're not going to have that in many other places. And there, everyone's excited. You go to see anything. So having that and kind of having an actually, kind of discerning, taste there. We had a good college radio station. I had, you know, groups of people who somehow fed me lots of underground music knowledge, but then also having just kind of the ubiquitous classic rock element.
Of course.
I feel like I understood like these kind of signifiers of all of American music history. Mm-hmm. Like I understood what a gated snare represented, you know, represents like the excess of the 80s and stuff. And I understand what a distortion pedal, like
a gated snare.
Yeah. Like a reverb,
explosion when you hit a snare drum in the 80s. Right. Yeah. Okay.
And so that, you know, represents a certain like form of excess and, you know, what distortion represents versus. Anyway, just all this stuff, this kind of class, just taking in American music, mm-hmm. what not necessarily very critically, but somewhat. So, and then when I heard Amps for Christ, it's like, oh, I see, you can take stuff from all these different places and you can re-put it together in a way to create your own. Mm-hmm. That's something completely new. And so I just ended up hanging out with them and playing with them for like a short amount of time, but I was really good friends with Henry and Tara, and I would go over there and we'd drink beer and he'd show me all these handmade instruments he made and we'd just, I don't know, shoot the shit, talk about everything. And so from there, I think I was.
But this was all in South Dakota. Still.
No, this is in California.
Oh, this is in California.
Yeah, this is in California.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. And then Gowns. Mm-hmm. Which was you and your then boyfriend, I suppose.
Yeah.
And someone else?
We sometimes had a drummer who now plays with, oh my God, what's her name? Julia Holter.
Oh, okay.
So it was Ezra Buchla and his Corey Fogle was sometimes in that. And right. So sometimes we do a two piece and we do a three piece.
Right. And Gowns like was more about you guys getting your drone out.
It wasn't, yeah, kind of. I mean, Ezra was kind of by default a little bit part of, well, he had a band called the Meishi that was like, when they saw them live, I thought it was like the best. He was like the best front person I'd ever seen. Where was I going?
What
was I
saying?
Oh yeah. His dad was the person who like invented the modular synthesizer on the West Coast.
Huh.
So it was like Moog on the East Coast, Buchla on the West Coast.
Oh, okay.
So like within, you know, kind of noise culture or whatever, that name is like very hallowed, you know. For whatever reason, we were kind of hanging out in what would, you know, considered like harsh noise scenes, like experimental scenes. Mm-hmm. And so we were kind of taking parts of that, but also there's like me, who's like this, you know, kind of scruffy looking, long, kind of greasy hair looking girl that's also like, you know, kind of doing this like poetic thing. And I remember one of the first show we ever played in San Francisco, it was actually in Oakland. We were playing with like these other kind of, the costume noise was really big at that time. So like people who were dressed up in these kind of wild costumes, absolutely no lyrics, barely any rhythm, no melody. Mm. And then to have me kind of come in there and, do these sort of poetic things, we can understand the lyrics, and also not have Ezra's like playing like a mandolin. Mm. And stuff like that. They hissed at us. They were like, they were like more hostile than the Depeche Mode crowds by quite a bit. So
there you go.
So we were in that scene, but it was kind of like controversial a little bit. It was some people, I think we were kind of threatening to like what felt like a movement.
How long did that last? As long as the relationship?
Kind of, yeah. We tried to make it last a little bit longer, but... Yeah.
But so you're in California now. The first time I met you was in Oakland.
Yeah.
At an arena show, remember that?
Yeah, right.
But I was... My impression of you, and that's... I was so impressed with meeting you because I had no idea. We just, you know, we liked some of the songs. Krista had dug you up, kind of.
Right, right. She had been following since Gowns, yeah, I think.
And so I show up there and I enter your world and I notice, oh my God, this girl is a real, do you know, is the word Gesamtkunstwerk?
I think that's something? What you said. Yeah, I don't know German.
It's not a, you know, you have Zeitgeist in kindergarten, but you don't have Gesamtkunstwerk. It's like this wholesome approach to all kinds of multidisciplinary work, you know, like you were in poetry, you were doing video art, you were doing, were you painting?
No, I don't paint, but I was doing different sorts of performance.
You were blogging, you were writing, you were recording, you were interested in technology. Everything sort of came together in this pad that you were hanging out with your then boyfriend, who was also building things and building his own effect pedals.
Yeah.
And it was just it just felt to me like, okay, this is a real hub for all kinds of creative things. Is that what happened? Did that come to you in California, or did you just take that and then it just bloomed there? And how did that develop?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, yeah, we definitely had something going on in Oakland because for one thing, like Leif, who, boyfriend, still partner now and still playing with EMA.
And now the violin.
Yeah. But he really made that space into something amazing. And it was kind of like a warehouse in West Oakland E type of thing. And, you know, he built a studio there. We were starting to throw shows there and just, you know, having all sorts of stuff. And we had to be able to do video and, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
So he built the space and you just walked right in there and filled it up with your stuff.
I mean, I guess so. Yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on. There was another roommate too who was also like working on a documentary with Tupac's old manager stuff. So there was like there were some things happening in that time and place. It was still when the Bay Area was affordable, so you had all sorts of freaks in Oakland, you know.
Right. Oakland is now also just
completely. I don't know. Last time we were in Oakland, we went to drive by the old space and it was gone, just completely razed.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure.
So then something weird happened. You made your first solo album.
Yeah.
And you put it out there into the world and the world actually loved it.
Yeah.
What did that do to you, that's now, how long is that? That's like 6 years ago.
Yeah, crazy.
So you've had a lot of time to reflect on that.
Oh God! Still don't even have all the answers.
No,
no.
Because there was everybody. I mean, from, you know, it was like number 3 record of the year in Spin magazine, and all this guy Pitchfork. Well, everybody was all over it.
Yeah.
Did that affect your creative?
Yeah,
ways?
I mean, I think so. It was. I mean, like you saw, we were like, kind of living this kind of weird warehouse life. And most of the shows, I'd never played EMA shows really before the record, you know? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like I was like in this tight band that had been doing stuff forever. Mm-hmm. So I was really unprepared, I think, to go from that scene, like you know, DIY warehouse. Noise,
yeah.
All that stuff to these things like, okay, now go play, you know, Pitchfork Fest or whatever.
Yeah. The New York Times wants to talk to you.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was very, I think musically, I just was unprepared and I didn't really know what to do with it. I think I was really good at being a composer and creating a world, but I didn't even know who to ask. I didn't even have any friends that I could be like, what's this like? What do I do? Is this contract good? Like, I didn't know anybody that was in this situation. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, and so yeah, that was a factor. And then I think I like doing interviews actually. So I would never say no to anybody. I was like, yeah, let's do this. And, I was drinking a lot too. Mm-hmm. Because that was something I had learned to do with Gowns, because Gowns got really stressful towards the end. So it was like a real...
That's stressful because it was also a relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah, and there was things that would always like break on. So it was kind of like a disaster from the beginning, like on the edge. It could go one way or the other.
Right.
You know, which I think was what made it compelling to people. And that's what I thought I could maybe bring into EMA.
Mm-hmm. But if I can just take your mind back to, to this point where... You get all this universal acclaim.
Yeah.
Right? You put your first thing out there. It's very innocent. You do it. You know, this is what I do here. Take it. And then the world comes, this tsunami of love and appreciation or whatever, kudos comes back at you. And did that change your perspective of what you were doing at that time, of your own? So does that stuff creep into your subconscious? When you go to the next record, do you then start thinking about what just happened?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's really
difficult. Can you remember that?
I just remember that on one hand, it was so amazing. It was so great. I also had like perfect faith in that record because I spent so much time, because I had so much time in a lot of ways to just like make a million mixes of everything.
It was a collection of several songs from many years.
Yeah, yeah, right. It was for sure. Right. Like Butterfly Knife, Marked, and Gray Ship, which are some like the best, I think, standout songs on there. You know, the ones we still play were written over years, like there were songs we performed with Gowns and stuff as well. So yeah, on one hand, it was absolutely fantastic. But I think it was really physically hard on me.
The touring
was really physically hard because I was saying yes to every interview. So I would do hours of interviews and then I would try and play a show. And I remember the first show in Berlin, we like totally kind of blew it. And it was because I had done like 6 hours or something before that and trying to really do a good job with all of it, trying to really answer questions, trying to like be a good sport, you know, and be thankful and be like appreciative and reciprocate the energy that was coming in.
And then you go on stage and you're fried.
Yeah, totally fried. I didn't get a chance to set up my own pedals that night either, which is just something I can't do. I got to, you know, even tonight with Depeche Mode, someone's going to help me set up my pedals. Then I have to go on there and be like, yo, this is right or not right. And then at the end, when it was time to write the next one, I remember going home and this was Christmas and like taking some psychedelics, which shall remain unnamed. And I felt like I had a big white cube in my brain that was all the press and all the like, you know, the kind of like digital stuff. Pictures of myself or whatever, all this thing that had been created. It was like this amorphous, all the words written about that record, all the pictures, all of everything. And I was having a bad trip, let's just say.
We should talk about the psychedelics now.
As
a warning.
So I was having a not good trip. And then I'll just say that some other substances entered the picture to kind of turn it around. And I was able to listen to Past Life Martyred Saints for the first time. I hadn't listened to it for like a year or a year and a half. And I was able to kind of calm down and be like, oh yeah, I can imagine thinking this chick's cool. So it was like two sorts of dissociation. One was like, oh my God, who is this person? It doesn't feel like me. It feels like all this other stuff. And then also putting it on and also still enjoying the work. You know.
Yeah. So then and this first record that we're talking about, Past Life, is has been lauded for its intense personal vulnerability, again, yeah, pain, the display of painful feelings, just the whole thing. Uh-huh. And so I think you distanced yourself a little bit from that for the second record. I think you got more, a little more topical and a little less, I don't want to throw myself onto this display. Yeah. So much. Is that right?
Well, I mean, also too, the things that had happened in my life up until then, there had been some, like when Gowns broke up, there was like things that were personal that was in that relationship that maybe were in kind of known throughout our small little scene, mm-hmm, or speculated, you know, cause it's like when you have like a, someone described us, this is not me, but someone described me and Ezra at the time as like the Brad and Angelina of the San Francisco noise scene or something. So there was a lot of like attention paid to our relationship. Mm. And every, you know, all the time that Past Life Martyred Saint, I mean, also Ezra's dad was sick and he was having a really hard time. So there was some kind of displays of not quite perfect mental health that, mm-hmm, happened. And I was really terrified the whole time with Past Life Martyred Saints that someone was going to ask me about these things in my past. So that was another thing that made me really nervous all the time. Like I was like, because I was not like recovered from these things that had, this intense relationship. So yeah, that was part of it. And then yeah, just being kind of like wrecked at the end. And also, you know, you have, once so many words have been written about you and all these things, it kind of takes on a life of its own. So yeah, it was very difficult for me to like kind of be personal, but then also I was really personal. It's just that like you saw where I was living before, the whatever you said, Gewohnkunst, the Kunst, something.
Gesamtkunstwerk. That word refers to you, not to your digs.
But I mean, I was living in this kind of,
yeah,
even though it was fucked up because it was West Oakland, it was kind of like this holistic,
yeah,
thing within a community. It was rooted within community and relationships and all this stuff. And then I had just spent a year and a half on the road with a whirlwind. Mm. And so it was very hard for me to even.
But that's when you moved to Portland, right?
Yeah, I know. I don't know if, yeah, I know. I moved to Portland after. Well, I decided to move to Portland, I think, before I even knew that the record was coming out.
Oh.
I wanted to move there because I thought my band was there. Like, yeah, the other thing that's about Past Life Martyred Saints is it's got my little sister on it, who I think, and it was recorded in Leif's studio. Mm-hmm. And I think that adds like this kind of secret sauce of like intimacy and things.
Oh,
and
no, it's totally, when we were looking at your band, it's like, oh, she got her boyfriend in the band. She's got her sister in the band.
Yeah.
And there was a bass player.
A bass player who was a dear friend of mine who quit like 2 weeks before Pitchfork. And then I had to call someone
Aaron,
else. And,
yeah. Yeah.
I'm still friends with, but yeah, I was pissed at him for a while.
Yeah. I don't know. You were going through lineup after lineup after lineup.
Yeah. Like I said, I didn't even know how to call, like, yeah, all these things. It was like, yeah, anyway.
So then second record, you know, and it was more, that was more personal. I sensed there was more of a discontent, pissed off.
I was pissed, but I didn't feel like it would make any sense for me to be.
What?
I didn't feel like I could be.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah.
Tell me more. Come on. This is,
you know, it's like the Midwest thing of like, well, I can't complain. Like, if you're a Midwesterner, you can't, I mean, even if your leg's cut off, you can't complain because you still got the other one or something.
That's the Midwest thing I was asking about earlier. Can't complain?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know, but so.
I wanted to hear it from you. Can't complain.
Yeah, I think it's like this certain, I don't know, no, certain sort of toughness. And so, yeah, if I had had this record that had this outpouring and this amazing reception and all this stuff, like, I didn't really, you know, why was I so mad?
Oh, plenty of reason. Plenty of reasons. Plenty of reasons.
What do you think?
Why you are so mad? I don't know. Let's talk about, so you do a second record and then you do a third record, and that's, the third record came out, this past, well, 2017, in August.
Yeah.
There's a song called Aryan Nation on that record. In August, the entire world looked at a place called Charlottesville and went, shit. And now you didn't write that song in August.
No.
But there was a display of that particular song. How did you feel about that? Did you see all that? I mean, I guess sort of this kind of fascism has been in the American society for a long time, but the display we got of all of them sort of uniting there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you believed in those songs. There were a number of people who said, are you sure you want to put out a song called Aryan Nation?
I didn't say that.
No, I said, that's what I said. Yeah, you were from the beginning. You were like, no, it's cool. You should do this. This is important. But yeah, I'd written that song like 3 years before that or something. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, also, I think with The Future's Void, which at the time, I think I was a little disappointed in the reaction, but also a little relieved, you know? But that one, I think, was also just a little bit soon. Because, you know, Exile in the Outer Ring got delayed a little bit, and I wrote all those songs 3 years ago or whatever, or a lot of them. And The Future's Void, I think, actually...
Did you feel that you were rushed?
I don't know. Maybe I rushed myself. I don't know. I mean, who knows?
Okay, but let's talk. I think the more interesting thing is actually the new one.
Yeah, okay.
Exile on the Outer
Except, Rain. You know, Martin Gore loves The Future's Void, and that's why I'm on this tour.
Oh, well, I love it too. But you've moved on. I think you've moved
on. Yeah. And, okay. You know, I just want to come back to it because I feel like it was like my redheaded stepchild, and I want to love it. Okay, so the new one, yeah.
So let's talk about Aryan Nation, because what you're describing this. Okay, so there's this the alt right or whatever you call them marching through Charlottesville, chanting "You will not replace us."
Oh my God! Yeah.
Right.
The hell? Yeah.
Well, but you think about this. Think this through. This white male angry mob shouting, "You will not replace us." What does that actually mean? Where's that coming from? What are they? What is their victimization? Where is this sense of victimization coming from? And what does it have to do with the way the picture that you are drawing in the song Aryan Nation? Because it's the bleakness that you describe in that very song. I think that these people are sensing, and they don't know what's going on. And so they're blaming whoever, you know, I mean, people in China or people in, you know, they don't blame the people on the home front they should be blaming. You tell me.
Well, Aryan Nation was kind of inspired by someone that I knew, not someone I knew kind of when I was from my childhood, but had lost contact with. Mm-hmm. And they had been in prison, and there was when I saw them again, there were so many questions that you can't really ask people. But I mean, American prisons are segregated.
Oh yeah.
And
they're loaded.
They're loaded.
Well, there's mass incarceration.
That's
a big problem.
It's a huge problem. Yeah. And so yeah, people break up into like gangs within there, including one that then the white gang, whatever is the Aryan Nations, is one of them. And just thinking about the cycle of kind of like poverty, drugs, and then
violence.
And then when you kind of hit the bottom there, then it's like because there's the real bleakness of like complete racial subdivision within that. You know, that's kind of like the end of the line, you know, it's like these prisons. But it's not that hard to end up there if you're from a certain place or background. I feel like I read a lot of the news, and I just kind of keep my eyes open for people, and I'll kind of lean into things. If something feels like it could be taboo or awkward, you know, it kind of means that it's like there's like some repression there, I guess, like societally. And that's sometimes the best things to write about. I didn't foresee this. I mean, I didn't foresee this stuff necessarily with like the marching in the streets and all that.
No, but you're an observer.
Yeah.
You're an observer. And through your, you know, and what you see inspires what you write, I suppose.
Yeah.
And what you read. You read a lot of books too.
I read a lot of books for sure. And I read a lot of journalism, long form journalism and stuff. And I just think I have like a good filter. Like I'm able to kind of just put a lot of information in and then have stuff come out. You know, and I think I'm like very American, you know, quintessentially American, having grown up in the Midwest, like just like able to represent that viewpoint very well.
Do you love America?
I would love to go somewhere else and put that filter to use in another place.
No, so many people are so proud of America, and I'm wondering what's there to love right now? What's the love? What's the fantasy these people are living in of the America, the American values and all of that stuff?
I mean, you have to understand that most of the people who love America have never been anywhere else. But they have no concept. And I mean, let me think about this.
I don't necessarily mean this in a negative or cynical way.
What is it about America?
Yeah, I mean, there is this.
I think it has great branding. I mean, like that flag, you know, they put it in lots of amazing places. Mm. And it's always been like, it's like kind of the birthplace of like image making.
Oh, yeah.
In a way. And so.
You must care about America because you sing about it.
I mean, like I said, I feel like just utterly American, and I feel like all my work is like truly, I think, representative of different of aspects of America that I think don't often end up in work, you know.
Okay, so another song on the new record, 33 Nihilistic.
Yeah, my two favorites that almost got off until.
Really?
And you remember that. I was like, should I take these off? And you're like, no.
Why would you take them off?
I don't know.
In the first place.
I don't know.
33 Nihilistic and Female. Explain to me your type of nihilism.
Okay, I've been thinking about this for years. I think there's a couple of things. I think I'm obsessed with the void. In a way that I'll probably explore my entire life. Like I'm obsessed with the void, you know, growing up in South Dakota is very empty.
Tell us what the void is.
Yeah. Right. I'm trying to figure it out. I think, yeah, just kind of like a nothingness that creeps into the corners of the, it's something that I think will probably, and I just noticed has informed my work for a long time, and I'll probably some ways keep exploring.
Can you be a little more concrete? Two sentences.
Okay, so like when I was really little, there was this movie called The Neverending Story. You don't know this?
Oh yeah, okay. Michael Ende. Right?
Maybe, yeah. I don't know. Yeah, but one of the things in there was the main problem or the main scary thing that was happening in this movie was that the nothing was coming. And then nothing was eating all of this world and just destroying it. And I think I've just reacted really strongly. And I've always had a little bit of fear of that the nothing is coming. And I think that the nothing, you know, can be internal. Like mm-hmm. you can be like, oh no, the nothing is inside of me. Or it can feel like it's around you. I think I've probably had a, I don't know, existential crisis or two or something. And I've been really, I'm just haunted by the idea of the nothing. Okay. I guess.
And you call that the void, the nothing, or?
Yeah, I mean,
an extension of the nothing?
Yeah, I guess maybe, I feel like the void, I don't know, maybe I should read some philosophy or something. I feel like religions and stuff have dealt with the term of the void, but I don't know, when you just say there's this movie called The Neverending Story mm-hmm. and the nothing, then I don't know.
That's maybe. Not philosophy.
Yeah, it doesn't sound as like official.
All right, 33 Nihilistic.
Okay, 33 Nihilistic and Female. I think there's a couple things going on. One is kind of like this noise ethos, which is kind of like the scene I came from, I think it's maybe not nihilist as much as it's renunciate, you know? So you're just like, you live with the bare minimum of things, and you don't, you know, there's almost like this spiritual aspect of it mm-hmm. where it's like the only thing I care about is my work and so but it's not a good look for women. It's not a look that women can often pull off, you know, where it's like,
why not?
I don't know, it's just, that's what I'm railing against, I guess. It's like, you can't just be like, yeah, I'm not gonna clean the fucking house, fuck that, you know, or like I don't prioritize my looks, my house, my cooking, my anything okay. over my work mm. over my artwork or whatever. It's just, I think it's kind of rare, and I wanted to kind of... So that's the kind of nihilistic part.
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel like there's a couple things with like 33. One is like to be a woman over... You're not supposed to really say if you're over your 30s, if you're like a lady. I mean, it's real, you know? People are like... It's
maybe in Hollywood.
I think too, in like indie rock or whatever. Really? I mean, I think there's some exception. I think people, it's changing a little bit, but it's like you're kind of supposed to play the ingenue or whatever, the young lady for as long as possible.
That's just the media obsession with the young and the new and the
So, but it felt like in some ways the most like rebellious statement I could make.
Okay.
To be like, hey, I'm 33. Also, the thing is, like, you know, Jesus died at 33.
Oh, yeah, did he?
Yeah, yeah. So it's like a Jesus age thing a little bit.
I don't know if he ever died, but yeah, okay. I feel there's some weird, different, other nihilism out there right now. And it's just, and it seems to be everywhere. And it seems to be, I don't know, utilized. This is weird new form of it, like... By neglecting realities, you still advance your own agenda. Do you know what I mean? Like media, politicians, people, they break a taboo. They say something they know is not right. They know it's not a fact. They know it's not a reality. They say it, they still say it because they, just by saying it, it opens up something new. It breaks a taboo and it gets them somewhere, even though they have to go, oh well, actually, I didn't mean it that way, or that wasn't true, or something like that.
I mean, it's a disregard of truth.
Media does it. The left media does it. Yeah, disregard of truth. Isn't that a form of nihilism, a modern weird?
I think that's probably a good point, where it's like, yeah, the one things that I guess most people could agree on is the importance of like these words like truth, beauty, justice.
Yeah.
Truth did seem like kind of the, you know, justice is hard to get everywhere, and that's not something that we always expect governments to, you know, they kind of already have lost their take on being able to be completely just. Beauty, I don't know. That's also doesn't seem like a concern. I don't know. But then, yeah, truth. And now it's, yeah, it does seem like a form of nihilism, I guess, to be like, wow, we don't care about the truth anymore. Like, we don't care about it at all.
We need that. There's a lot to sing and complain about, I guess, right now.
It's a crazy time.
Shouldn't there be more songs of discontent right now? I mean, now is the time, I think. What do you think? Protest songs, the return of the protest song. Would that be ridiculed in this day and age? And which genres are there? Hip hop? Is hip hop the protest?
I don't know. Hip hop kind of used to be more, but now, you know, it's kind of, a lot of it's still pretty capitalist, you know, now. There's a lot of money.
Yeah, true.
The goal.
Yeah, money does get in the way. So tell me about The Outer Ring.
Mm-hmm.
What's the concept of The Outer Ring? Your new album is called Exile in the Outer Ring.
Yeah, so The Outer Ring is basically kind of like the suburbs, mm-hmm. but it's kind of an inverse from what you would think of typically as like, you know, the American suburbs, because, you know, living in Portland especially, I've seen like my neighborhood be transformed from like a place that apparently was kind of a sketchy part of town, though me coming from West Oakland, yeah. I did not see that.
Nice.
But into a place where it's just all like cupcake shops and like ad agencies. And so, you know, where do people go? I mean, you saw it already in Oakland too.
Let me take the cupcake shops and ad agencies. That's good. That's a good one.
That's basically what it is. And so, you know, where... And you see it in Oakland too. Where are people going to go, and who's going to end up there? And it's going to be, you know, kind of the economically disadvantaged. And in America, that's often tied to like, you know, race or ethnicity or whatever. And so where are we all going to end up? We have to keep kind of moving further and further out. And in Portland already, the suburbs and the places on the outskirts are poorer and more diverse than the city center, which I feel like is kind of an inverse of how it used to be, I don't know, even 20 years ago or something. But I'm kind of excited about it. And in fact, I'm going to try and, my dream, I'm going to bring it full circle right now, is to try and build a sort of trailer park of sorts out on the outer ring right now.
All right.
Yeah.
Build a trailer. Full circle.
Yeah, artist colony trailer park in the outer ring. Yeah. I don't know. Or, you know,
that's your latest idea?
That's kind of like, I think, I mean, I miss places like LA a lot and New York a lot because I miss sort of it was hard to go from Oakland, which is like so diverse.
But what does that mean if we all desert the cities and leave these glitzy buildings and their ad agencies behind and move out into this recluse exile?
Well,
is that,
I think it takes some community building out there.
Yeah.
You know?
But that's the easy part. What do we leave behind?
What do we leave behind? Well,
deserted strips of concrete and homelessness.
But that's not what's happening there now. Now it's like,
I saw tents everywhere.
Yeah.
Tents full of homeless people downtown.
In
Seattle,
Portland, yeah.
Downtown LA.
Downtown LA, yeah.
Maybe downtown Portland. I'm just, you know.
You're just wondering. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure what the thing is like, you know, the end all be all in America is money, you know, it's not truth and it's not social welfare. So there's only so much I can personally do as someone who doesn't have a lot of money. So I think what I can do is try and go to a place where I have the possibility of building up an alternate form of community and try and make it integrated.
Okay, you're a pissed off artist.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean,
you know,
I feel
you sound
tired.
Pretty pissed off to me when you sing those songs on
stage.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You feel tired now?
It's really wearying to be lied to over and over and over again every day. Like, it's really like the,
oh my God, yeah.
The Trump administration is wearying.
Oh, I was there for 10 days last year in December. I was over there for 10 days and I could not wait to get out.
Yeah.
It was just, it was giving me, yeah, it was clogging me up.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about I'm looking at those things and I'm thinking, okay, whatever happens there will happen over here.
I see.
Ultimately, in 5 years or 10 years or 2 years, things come over here. We now have a party here that looks and talks just like the Tea Party.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And they're still on the fringe. They're on the far right fringe, but they have just been voted into parliament here. 97, people.
Wow.
They're sending into parliament.
How does it like the Tea Party? They're just like less government. They want less government. So.
No, they're just, in the sort of abortion.
Oh God.
You know, that kind of, that stuff is
weird. Well, but that's so weird because the Tea Party, I mean, it's so hypocritical because they're like, we want less government interference in our lives.
Yeah.
And you can't do what you want with your body or whatever. Is
exactly.
That,
oh yeah. All that. You can't do what you want with your body. Same sex is also not appreciated. But it's just some of the crazy ideas that I first heard from Tea Party people that, you know, all of a sudden here, you know, media. We have fine national media here.
Yeah.
They should be reporting in a neutral kind of way. But obviously they're critical when these Islamophobe, anti-democratic forces are rearing their heads. And so obviously these people are going, oh, this is all going against free speech. We shouldn't be having even this state-controlled media, you know, national public radio and television in Germany.
The fake news, as Trump called it.
Here they're called the system media.
So, I mean, I could – the thing that's – I mean,
all
Europe,
this stuff is happening, and I'm trying to figure out what to do. What's there to do? And you sound defeated.
Well,
you're like, I'm going to go to the outer ring and build an artist community.
How is that? I don't know if that's defeated though. That's taking action.
That's true.
The thing is with America is, I mean, Europe is already, you know, split up into countries.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you think that's going to happen?
I don't know. I could see America. I could see the West Coast being like, you know what? Fuck y'all. And, you know, California, if California wants to go, Oregon and Washington will probably go with it.
Right.
And I mean, I can see like
the ununited states.
I don't know if that'll happen, but like, I know that the West Coast specifically like already has refuted the Trump campaign on specific things. And they've had all the governors of all three states signing things as like a unified thing against certain aspects of like the immigration policy. And so that would be interesting.
Do you have to get going?
Yeah.
Oops. Okay. Well, we have to go sound check. Erica, thank you. It was a pleasure to have you here and talk to you.
You too.
Sorry, I have to break this off right away. Okay.
Okay, bye.
Oh, man. That was it. She checked the time on her phone, and that was it. She had to run off to soundcheck in the arena for her arena rock support slot, so that was it. She goes through this world with wide open and observant eyes, and she takes it all in, and I would have loved to discuss so many more topics with her, but, you know, it wasn't meant to be. So later that same day, she delivered a kick-ass set to the German Depeche Mode Obsessives, and they actually appreciated her. It was good. It was really good. So, well, next time. Next time we'll have more time, maybe. But all right, that was it. Erica Anderson, a.k.a. EMA. Go check out her music. Go see her play. Thank you for listening to this episode of Spill the Wine. My name is still Christoph Ellinghaus, and I am checking out.